My name is Mark Williams. I'm the president of the Hamilton branch of the Canadian International Council. And this evening, we're happy to host Eve Engler for the launch of his new book, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. Ooh. And for those of you who don't know, Eve is the co-author of Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social, and Ecological Decay, as well as Canada and Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. And he is the author of The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada and Israel, Building Apartheid, and Playing Left Wing, From Rink Rat to Student Radical, all of which are available at the back table of Bridges. Great. So it is my pleasure to call upon Eve Engler.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks to the Canadian National Council for putting this on. Thanks to everyone for coming out. This is a part of the book tour for this book, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, which some people might ask, why bother writing a book about a guy who's been dead for 40 years, who's been dead longer than I've been alive? I would say that most people in this room have been alive, but that may not be the case for many people in the room. What's the point in dealing with somebody who's so far in the past? And the first motivation for writing the book is coming across left-wing or progressive-minded commentators that cite Lester Pearson's foreign policy as some sort of symbol that we should be striving towards today. Right? When criticizing Stephen Harper's foreign policy, people like Linda McQuaig, left-wing columnist in the Toronto Star, Stephen Staples from the Rideau Institute, Jack Layton, Elizabeth May, Naomi Klein, are all people I cite in the introduction that at one time or another have cited Lester Pearson's foreign policy as some sort of positive symbol. Coming across that and being frustrated by seeing that, knowing that it wasn't correct, after having done research in the Black Book in Canada and Israel, not with time knowing how incorrect it was, not knowing that point. So being frustrated with seeing progressives saying positive things about Pearson, there's one reason for writing the book, but the more important reason is that if we want to understand Stephen Harper's foreign policy today, we can find a lot of parallels with Lester Pearson's foreign policy. There is, in many ways, a straight line between Lester Pearson's foreign policy and Stephen Harper's foreign policy. And that's what I'm going to spend the bulk of the talk going into the parallels between the two politicians. And for those who are not familiar with Lester Pearson, he was the most important Canadian foreign policy diplomat slash politician in the post-World War II period, in the two decades after World War II. He entered external affairs in 1928. He became Canada's ambassador in Washington in 1946. He became the head of external affairs for a couple of years, head of bureaucratic external affairs for a couple of years, was external minister from 1948 to 1957. And then was prime minister from 1963 to 1968. He is what the Foreign Affairs Building today is named after, Lester B. Pearson Building. So he still is preeminent foreign policy symbol in this country. And so to respond to some of those who cite Pearson in this positive, glowing kind of way, a little bit of what he was involved with. So for instance, he had Canada send weapons to the French through the NATO Mutual Assistance Program while the French were putting down the independence struggles in Vietnam, in Algeria, when there were 400,000 French troops in Algeria fighting against the independence movement there. The lead bureaucrat in external affairs wanted Canada to move away from the French position. Lester Pearson, as external minister, pushed for continued Canadian support for the French. When a peace group, the Peace Congress, called for the abolition of nuclear weapons, Pearson, as external minister, called on Canadians to destroy that peace group. There was a University of Toronto chapter of the Peace Congress that was taken over by engineering students that were hostile to the group. Pearson actually went to a small community meeting in Toronto and celebrated this action, called on Canadians across the country to do similar things against the Peace Congress. Pearson supported the two most infamous early CIA coups in Iran in 1953 and Guatemala in 1954 against Jacob Arbenz in Guatemala. The Canadian complicity was nothing like the coup in Haiti in 2004 that the Paul Martin government was involved with, but nevertheless, fairly substantial Canadian complicity, particularly in the case of Iran. Canada supported the British blockade of Iranian oil, a boycott of Iranian oil after Iran nationalized its oil. Pearson criticized Iranians for nationalizing their oil, which had been owned by the British for British company, the predecessor to British Petroleum, had been owned by the profited from by the British for four decades. Canada engaged in the boycott of Iran's oil. Canada began its diplomatic relations with Iran just after the coup, after Mossadegh was overthrown in Iran, and the documents at External Affairs are basically communique on the matter, communiques from the British and from the Americans, all in the direction of supporting the coup in Iran. In 1964, asked in the House of Commons to call for Nelson Mandela's release from prison by an NDP member of parliament, Pearson refused to call for Mandela's release from prison. And that reflects his general sympathy to the apartheid regime in South Africa that went back to his time as external minister, where the South African ambassador to the UN referred to Pearson and Paul Martin Sr. as good friends of South Africa. Similarly, while prime minister, after South Africa was pushed out of the Commonwealth, there was calls from the NDP to have Canada break off its preferential trade ties with South Africa that were tied into preferential Commonwealth trade ties to South Africa. Pearson refused to break off those special trade relations, even though South Africa was no longer part of the Commonwealth. And while an author like Linda McQuaig will refer to Pearson's distaste for colonialism, that's the word she used, distaste for colonialism, the record is quite different. So for instance, during time of British colonialism in Africa, Canada's relations with British Africa were, of course, controlled by London. I saw nothing in the record to suggest that Pearson opposed that. And in fact, when there were growing calls for independence, this is what Pearson had to say in the House of Commons in January 1957. He said, quote, "No people in the world have proved themselves more dependable defenders of freedom than have the British. Those countries which still have direct responsibilities for non-self-governing territories," a non-self-governing territory would be called a colony, "should not be made to feel at the United Nations or elsewhere that they are oppressors to be deprived arbitrarily of their rights or indeed their reputations." Right? That was Pearson's response to growing calls for independence from British colonial rule in Africa. Pearson threatened to quit as external minister if Canada didn't send ground troops to Korea in the Korean War. 1950-1953, Korean War, as many as 3-4 million people were killed in the Korean War, and it was a war fought under the UN banner, but it was led by the US, so it was General MacArthur, US general, that headed up the mission. And he wasn't subject to American controls, or sorry, to UN controls. He was only subject to US controls, but it was under a UN banner. So it was really a US war, US-led war. And Pearson had supported Canada getting involved in Korea, going back to earlier, years earlier, in fact, and pushed for Canada's involvement in a whole series of different bodies that were UN bodies that were dealing with the issue of Korea, that was basically laying the groundwork for war. And then Canada sent three naval vessels immediately when the Americans invaded Korea. Canada sent three naval vessels, but Prime Minister Senghor and Defense Minister Claxton were a little bit wary of sending ground troops And Pearson pushed in an August letter to Saint-Laurent, basically insinuated that he would resign as external minister of Canada and send ground troops. And to get a sense of the Korean War is not particularly well understood, it's still very contested, but it was a horrible human tragedy. And at one point, the Americans stopped bombing North Korea because every building of more than two stories had been destroyed. Right? And this is to give a sense of the horror and to give a sense of Pearson's response to that horror, this is an article from a passage from a New York Times article from February 1951 about how American bombing raid had destroyed a hamlet of 200 people. It wiped out the whole hamlet in North Korea. It explained, this is New York Times speaking, it explained, quote, "A napalm raid hit the village 3 or 4 days ago when the Chinese were holding up the advance. And nowhere in the village have they buried the dead because there is nobody left to do so. This correspondent came across one old woman, the only one who seemed to be left alive, dazedly hanging up some clothes in a blackened courtyard filled with the bodies of 4 members of her family. The inhabitants throughout the village and in the fields were caught and killed and kept the exact postures they had held when the napalm struck. A man about to get on his bicycle, 50 boys and girls playing in an orphanage, a housewife, strangely unmarked, holding in her hand a page torn from a Sears Roebuck catalog." Right? This is a description of incredible horror that in most people, I would assume, in this room, brings forward a certain level of compassion and being disturbed. Pearson's response to this New York Times article was to send a memo to Canada's ambassador in Washington to ask why the U.S. media censors that were in place during the war had allowed that report to get into the New York Times. He was concerned with how that report would affect Asian opinion. Right? He wasn't concerned with what I think most people in this room, I presume, was concerned with, which is the human tragedy. He was concerned with how this would affect the fighting of the war. And I think that speaks to a bit of his imperial-minded mindset. But the thrust of the rest of what I'm going to talk about are the parallels between Stephen Harper's foreign policy and Lester Pearson's foreign policy. And in his biography, Pearson describes the creation of NATO as, quote, "the most important thing I participated in." Right? Most Canadians, when they think of Lester Pearson, they think of the Suez Crisis, the peacekeeping force in Suez. Right? But Pearson was really explicit that it was NATO, which was the main thing he was proud of having been involved in creating. Which makes complete sense when you understand what happened in the Suez Crisis in 1956 and the creation of the peacekeeping force. What happened there was that the British, the French, and the Israelis invaded Egypt because Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. They weren't happy with that. And the Americans opposed that invasion. Washington opposed the invasion of Egypt because it wanted to tell the former colonial powers, the British and French, that there was a new boss in the region, the US. And it was also concerned that the British-French invasion would add to Moscow's prestige among the anti-monarchist movement that was growing in the Arab world. And the U.S. still had a certain level of support with that anti-monarchist movement. So Pearson, in 1956, created the peacekeeping force to protect NATO from internal division, right? The Americans on one side, the French and British on the other side. Obviously, a division within NATO was catastrophic for the alliance, which is based upon the idea of we all go to war if anyone is attacked. So the point of the peacekeeping mission was to protect NATO. It wasn't about Egyptian civilians. It wasn't about Egyptian sovereignty. So I think that makes us understand why Pearson, while 95%, 99% of Canadians, if you ask them when they think of Pearson, what does he symbolize, they would say peacekeeping. It makes sense that he would himself focus on his role in the creation of NATO, because for him, peacekeeping was about protecting NATO. And what was NATO about? Right? Officially, it was about protecting the US, Western Europe, from Soviet invasion, Russian invasion after World War II, which is a joke. I mean, it's laughable. During World War II, the Soviets had, or Russia had as many as 25 million Russians were killed. The place was much, much weaker than the U.S. I think something like 40%, the U.S. had 40% of the world's GDP. The idea that the Soviets would invade the U.S. is completely absurd, or even Western Europe, when the U.S. was far and away the most powerful power in the world after World War II. So what NATO was really about was two main things. One that has little to do with the peril of Steve Harbor today, and the other that has a lot to do. The first part was that during World War II, the communist parties in Italy and France had gained a lot of prestige, right? Because it was them who were fighting against Mussolini in Italy, against the Nazis in France. So after World War II, communist parties did quite well in elections. They probably would have won the first post-World War election in Italy, and they won 30% of the vote in France. And there was a sense in Western Europe that communism was the wave of the future. So what NATO was about strengthening the Western European elite's confidence in the face of growing socialist communist movements. Right? And Pearson was actually somewhat explicit about this. So for instance, in March of 1949, he told the House of Commons, quote, "The power of the communists, wherever that power flourishes, depends on their ability to suppress and destroy the free institutions that stand against them. They pick them off one by one, the political parties, the trade unions, the churches, the schools, the universities, the trade associations, even the sporting clubs and the kindergartens." The kindergartens. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization is meant to be a declaration to the world that this kind of conquest from within will not in the future take place amongst us, right? So what NATO was about, in large part, was strengthening the resolve of the Western European elite in the face of internal left-wing political movements. The other part of what NATO was about was, during World War II, the former colonial powers, most importantly, the French and the British, were weakened. Right, after World War II, there was rise in independence movements. Obviously, India got its independence just after World War II. In Vietnam, there was a serious independence struggle. Chinese in 1949 broke away from foreign domination. The Indonesians. And so, if the former colonial powers wanted to maintain some semblance of their world domination, they needed to work together. And alongside that, of course, was the growing U.S. hegemon. And so what NATO was a way for the former colonial powers with the new growing U.S. hegemon to maintain their position in the world of dominance. And Pearson, on occasion, was relatively explicit about this. So in 1951, he told the House of Commons, quote, "The Middle East is strategically far too important to the defense of the North Atlantic area, i.e. NATO, to allow it to become a power vacuum or to pass into unfriendly hands." In 1953, he said, quote, "There is now only a relatively small geographical gap between Southeast Asia and the area covered by the North Atlantic Treaty, which goes to the eastern boundaries of Turkey." That small geographical gap is something like 5,000 kilometers. But the point of NATO was to rule the world. And he said similar things about the Pacific area, about NATO being an alliance to maintain control of the Pacific area. And it wasn't just a rhetorical support with NATO for world domination. It was concrete. Canada sent tens and tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in today's money, in NATO mutual aid program weapons to the French, as I mentioned earlier, as they put down the anti-colonial struggles in Algeria, in Indochina, in Vietnam. In 53, Pearson told the House, quote, "The assistance we have given to France as a member of the NATO Association may have helped her recently in the discharge of some of her obligations in Indochina, i.e. Canada's weapons have helped put down the independence movement in Vietnam. This is in the House of Commons. This isn't something that's hidden. You can go to Hanson and read these quotes. So when we talk about 1,000 Canadian military trainers, that's what we call them now in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, right? When we talk about Canada's NATO bombing of Libya, there's a very clear parallel to what Lester Pearson was thinking about when establishing NATO, right? This was the point of NATO. We're seeing that play out today, the point of NATO. And of course, to respond, some people say, again, it was about the Soviet threat. Well, if it was about the Soviet threat, why would NATO continue after the end of the Cold War, right? What I should have said at the start is that Pearson played a very important role in the formation of NATO. And Canada, some people say that it was actually a Canadian idea going back to late 46. Some of the early public statements for a NATO-type organization were by Canadian politicians in 47. And Pearson attended a secret meeting with British-American officials in 1948 to establish what would eventually become NATO. So there is a clear parallel between what Pearson saw as the most important thing he was involved with, the creation of NATO, and Stephen Harper's foreign policy today. Another parallel, very clear parallel, is the question of Palestinian rights, the question of Zionism. Pearson was a staunch supporter of Zionism, not because he was sympathetic to Jews. He was actually, he upheld very anti-Semitic Canadian policy. He supported not having Jewish refugees, post-World War II Jewish refugees in Europe, be allowed to immigrate to Canada. He was supportive of Zionism, most importantly, at the UN in 1947. When the British handed their mandate of Palestine to the UN in 47, and the international body was supposed to come up with some sort of agreement, some sort of plan for what to do with the mandate. And Pearson he headed up the first commission that set up the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, which would then go to Palestine to look into the matter, to investigate what should be done. And he defined the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine mandate very broadly. So he included the question of post-World War II Jewish refugees in that mandate, right? So as if the question of what Nazis had done to Jews had to, had something to do with what British imperialism or colonialism had done in Palestine. He then played an important role in a second committee that, once the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine returned its report, he pushed the majority report, which was largely authored by a Canadian, Ivan C. Rand, the Supreme Court Justice. And that was a partition plan that was bitterly resisted by the indigenous Palestinian population. It was a partition plan that gave the Zionist movement 55% of historic Palestine, even though the Jewish community was less than a third of the population, even though they owned less than 7% of the land. And the partition plan basically provided the diplomatic cover, international legitimacy, for what the Zionist movement would later perpetrate, which is the Nakba, which is the expulsion of 85% of Palestinians from their homeland, and largely destruction of Palestinian society in later 1947 and 48. So Pearson played an important role there at the UN in those negotiations. When Nasser came to power in 1952 in Egypt, Pearson told Canada's ambassador, Israel's ambassador in Ottawa, that Canada would look more favorably on weapon sales to Israel because Nasser was seen as unreliable. So Canada increased its weapon sales to Israel after Nasser came to power at Pearson's direction. Canada played a diplomatic role in laying the groundwork for Israel's 1967 invasion of its neighbors, where it captured the Golan Heights, Egypt, Sinai, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. Canada pushed forward this resolution at the UN, Canada and Denmark, calling for Egypt to end its blockade of Israeli shipping through the Strait of Tehran. And this, in response to this, Egyptian newspaper Al Aram referred to Canada as, quote, a stooge of Western powers who seek to colonize the Arab world with Israel's help. After Israel conquered Egypt, Sinai, the Golan, West Bank, and Gaza, Pearson said that an Israeli withdrawal from those areas, quote, should only be accompanied by effective international guarantees of security of Israel. Right, it's always a question of the security of Israel, same kind of language we see today, even though it was clear that Israel was the predominant military force and had just won the 67 war in a very short period. And to get a sense of what was motivating Pearson's pro-Israel policy, you can find that in a memo he wrote to cabinet, an internal memo in 1952. It said, quote, with the whole Arab world in a state of internal unrest, that's after the British-backed monarchy had been overthrown in Egypt, and in the grip of mounting anti-Western hysteria, Israel is beginning to emerge as the only stable element in the whole Middle East area. He went on to explain, quote, Israel may assume an important role in Western defense as the southern pivot of current plans for the defense of the Eastern Mediterranean, i.e. Israel is a Western military base in the heart of the Arab world. Or as he put it in his biography, quote, Israel is, quote, an outpost, if you will, of the West in the Middle East. Right? That's very similar language to what we hear from Jason Kenney today about why Canada is so staunchly supportive of Israel's ongoing dispossession of Palestinians. So there's some clear parallels on that question between Lester Pearson and Stephen Harper. A final parallel, which is a little bit more broad, is on the question of the war in Vietnam. And this is what Linda McQuaig had to say about Pearson's role in the war in Vietnam in her book, Holding the Bully's Coat. She claimed that, quote, one could argue that Pearson's urgings may have, in some small way, contributed to ending the US war effort in Vietnam. It's beyond ridiculous. Pearson, on dozens of occasions, said things like, quote, my government, quote, supports the purposes and objectives of United States policy in Vietnam. Jeez. Pretty explicit. May 1967, he said, quote, I believe that the United States moved into Vietnam in the first place to help South Vietnam at the invitation of the government of that country to defend itself against military action and subversive terrorism. And you can find dozens and dozens of similar passages in the House of Commons where Pearson made his support for the US war in Vietnam abundantly clear. But it wasn't just rhetoric, right? Pearson wasn't just rhetorically in support of the US war in Vietnam. It was concrete help, aid. Canada became the leading per capita exporter of arms during the US war in Vietnam, arms exports to the US, of course, to be used in Vietnam, which Pearson knew were being used in Vietnam. The US tested chemical weapons in Canada, because they thought that this would, there was some similar kind of terrain, similar kind of vegetation to parts of Vietnam, so they're to figure out how to defoliation of Vietnamese terrain. Canadian aid went to propping up the South Vietnamese regime. Canada played an important role in the International Control Commission. Canada was one of three countries that sat on the International Control Commission, which went back to the Geneva Accords in 1954, which was supposed to bring about the peaceful reunification of North and South Vietnam. And immediately, as External Minister Pearson okayed Canadian officials, there were as many as 170 of them on the International Control Commission in Vietnam. He okayed Canadian officials spying on the North Vietnamese for the Americans. His only concern was not to publicly say that they were getting this information from Canada. And in the book, Noam Chomsky has a foreword to Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping. And in the book, in the foreword, he refers to Pearson as a war criminal. He describes a story, an instance when he, in the 80s, when he went on Peter Zosky's Morningside on CBC. And previously, when he went on Zosky's program, he would always criticize U.S. foreign policy. And Zosky was happy to hear criticism of U.S. foreign policy. This time, he decided he was going to change things up. And Zosky asked him about his arrival. And he said, I just arrived at War Criminal Airport. The Lester B. Pearson Toronto Airport, of course. And Zosky completely lost it. He just completely freaked out at Chomsky on air and started haranguing him, basically yelling at him for how dare you call this great peacemaker Lester Pearson a war criminal. And so what Chomsky's referring to when he calls Pearson a war criminal, above all else, is the role that Canadian ICC commissioner played in delivering U.S. bombing threats to the North Vietnamese. And Pearson okayed that, according to the Pentagon Papers, the internal U.S. government documents about the war in Vietnam, in a meeting between Pearson and Lyndon Johnson in 1964. And so the Canadian ICC commissioner would go from Ottawa down to Washington to be briefed, and would go to the officials in Hanoi and would tell them, if you don't do this, we will bomb you. And ultimately, the Americans do begin a large-scale bombing campaign against North Vietnam. As many as 100,000 people are killed in that bombing campaign. And without a doubt, the bombing of North Vietnam was a war crime. And Pearson's complicity in that is why Chomsky, at least, refers to him as a war criminal. Moving towards a conclusion, when we talk about Lester Pearson, right, we talk about, you know, he's got this symbol, he's symbolized today as something, which I think after, I would hope to believe after hearing this presentation, people are at least going to question. But what does Pearson symbolize in Canadian foreign policy? What he symbolizes, above all else, and his role in the war in Vietnam symbolizes, or the parallels today, what Pearson symbolizes is the shift of Canadian foreign policy from the British Empire to the U.S. Empire, right? That happened during World War II and after World War II. And Pearson saw the changing winds in the world earlier than most other Canadian diplomats and politicians, right? He understood that the U.S. was, during World War II, the U.S. was growing and becoming more powerful, and he understood that it would serve the interests of the Canadian elite to build the U.S. empire, right? To push forward the post-World War II U.S. empire. That U.S.-centered multilateral imperialism would serve Canadian interests, right? After World War II, Canada was the second biggest creditor nation in the world, had the fourth or fifth biggest army. And so Pearson went about pushing forward a new multilateral order that was Washington-centered. And unfortunately, that's what we're living under still today, right? And I think that when you talk about Stephen Harper's foreign policy, he's often, you know, even ahead of Obama in pushing a sort of militaristic, imperialistic kind of policy. And there are lots of roots of that policy in what Lester Pearson was establishing in the post-World War II period. And so this is how one author, John Price, in a 2011 book, describes what was happening at External Affairs and what Pearson was pushing, what shift he was pushing in the post-World War II period. What I am proposing is not just that the Canadian government played a supporting role in the emerging global order in which U.S. power would predominate, a position that others have argued before, but rather that it actively encouraged the United States to take on this role, and that it did so due to the values shared by the men in the foreign policy establishment of both countries, values that reflected ideas about race and empire reinforcing their belief that the Euro-American powers had to play a significant role in Asia as well as elsewhere. In the era of decolonization, the Canadian government aligned the country with American imperialism. That's still what's going on today, right? With Stephen Harper's foreign policy, he is continuing that trajectory of a U.S.-centered global empire. And I think that's why Pearson, in fact, rather than anything about him actually being about peacekeeping, why he is still such a symbol in our society is because he plays such an important role in establishing the foreign policy that we continue to, continue to push or be part of today. And some people, when hearing this, they think that I have a hate on for Lester Pearson. And in fact, he was a nice guy. From everything that I read about him, he was a nice father. He was supposed to be very sociable. And so it's not a matter of this, demon of an individual. It was more of a structural issue, right? He was an ambitious guy operating in an unjust world, right? If you want to move up in the world of external affairs or Canadian politics at that time, and quite frankly, still today, you had to ingratiate yourself with the powerful, whether those powerful people were in Washington or among the Canadian business elite. That's where you put your emphasis. I think the issue is much more structural than it is just a matter of a bad guy, and that's part of why I'm so uncomfortable about the progressive-minded people who will cite Lester Pearson's foreign policy when criticizing Stephen Harper's more aggressive, militaristic foreign policy today, right? That's when Linda McQuaig cites Pearson, she's I think the spirit is positive, right? Pearson or Harper, is going in a more militaristic direction, and she's basically saying we shouldn't go that direction, but we should return to it, a different time. So it's an attempt to put a check on the worst elements of Canadian foreign policy. And so in that sense, I support it. I support what someone like Linda McQuaig or others would do in citing Pearson. But the problem with doing that, or part of what happens when you do that, is you're implicitly downplaying the structural problem in Canadian foreign policy. Right? You're basically saying we have this bad crew that got into office, and we just have to go back to that previous crew, right? That's not my reading of Canadian foreign policy history. My reading of Canadian foreign policy history is that it has always been fundamentally self-serving and elite-driven, and the rest of the world would do better with less Canada, right? You can't say that in the mainstream. You can't say that in Toronto Star. You can't be a columnist in the Toronto Star and say that. You can't establish a think tank like the Rideau Institute and say things like that. That's not really allowed in the discussion. So what you do is you say, okay, well, Harper's bad, and we just got to return to a previous politician. When in fact, I would argue, and I have nothing positive to say about Stephen Harper's foreign policy, but I would argue that Pearson was responsible for way more, or was complicit in way more death and destruction than Stephen Harper, right? The war in Afghanistan or Libya has nothing on it compared to the killing fields of Vietnam or the killing fields of Korea that Lester Pearson participated in. So for those who still have sympathy for this idea of Lester Pearson, the truth may hurt, but it also sets you free. Thank you very much.